Settling into a comfortable meditation posture. And having a sense of alignment in the body so that the head and shoulders and spine are a balanced and aligned posture. That when we find that alignment, we can feel a kind of stability and balance, weight moving through the spine, not stressing the back or neck. Just checking in with yourself, how you are right now. Letting your breath calm the body. Some slow exhalations. Settling. Grounding. Letting the breath be a focal point. You can feel the breath, though, in a larger space of body and mind. We're not trying to have a narrow awareness, but an open one. Might include the sounds and feeling of your own environment. A sense of ease. Presence. The breath, a gentle rhythm of movement, of sensation. Let the attention come to a particular point of sensation in the breath. So even in this spacious mind, there is still a kind of precision. Kind of balance between a very careful, close attention with an openness and ease. The touch of breath at the nostrils, gentle touch of air coming in and out. With a rhythmic rising and falling of the chest and belly. As we cultivate this attention to the breath, we're also faced with the wanderings of the mind, the movements of mind. Something so simple, being mindful of the breath, can become messy and complicated as the mind sweeps us away, if we get caught in craving or anxiety, resentment. Or just a daydream and fantasy. Then we find ourselves with an internal conflict between our intention to be present and meditate and the pull of the mind to run off into habitual thinking. Here we need to be persistent in returning, letting go of thoughts, coming back to the breath. But this persistence must be gentle. If we become aggressive or irritated with the mind, we create more agitation. We try to bring a quality of acceptance and kindness to the wandering mind. Nonetheless, with a determination to let go. Our acceptance isn't passive. There is an accompanying effort. Our thoughts can be very compelling, even addictive. To develop motivation to let go of the thoughts, we need to look closely at their effects. To look closely at what they are doing for us, or telling us. And what we will see is that they are fundamentally unsatisfactory. They do not bring the promised relief that we might imagine they'll give us, that they'll somehow bring an answer or fix something. Rather, they just reinforce themselves, reinforce the craving, aversion that's at their root. When we see this and understand this, that desire and aversion are fundamentally unsatisfactory, then we are motivated to let go. Then we become clear that the thoughts are not bad, that stopping thinking is not some good thing to do, that shows we're meditating properly, but rather that letting go is simply a relief, what the Buddha calls the end of suffering, the dukkha or suffering that comes with those cravings. All right, so I'm gonna continue today to talk about the hindrances. This, as I've mentioned, this could go on for a while. I do think, you know, the five hindrances: desire, aversion, sleepiness, restlessness, doubt. It's a topic that's covered in most Dharma books and oftentimes on retreats, and they just have so much relevance, and there's so much intertwined with the challenges we face in our lives, and certainly in terms of addiction and recovery, you know, desire and aversion are sort of the two primary things we have to deal with. The desire for the intoxicant or the substance or the behavior, and then the aversion to the feelings that we want to get rid of. So, you know, they really, you know, call for us to explore in many dimensions of craving and aversion. And we don't want to talk today about the second hindrance, aversion, and start by going back to the suttas that I mentioned a couple classes ago, I think, which were the two similes the Buddha has of the hindrances. That one simile, the pond simile, where the hindrance of aversion is like a pond that's boiling hot, or it's like water that's boiling hot and it's bubbling. And the other simile is that the idea of aversion as like a chronic disease. And what I like about these two is that they both point to kind of the physical elements of aversion: the heat, which we recognize in anger, but even maybe more destructive, the feeling of a disease, of being sick, that when we're just caught in resentment or aversion, or just, and there's a tie-in with depression here, which that might be my next class, if I can pull myself out of my current depression enough to talk about it. That, you know, there's just kind of physical dullness and heaviness that can come with that state of negativity. As you know, when we have, so this is particularly true of when we're having aversive thoughts about ourself, right? Not just anger and resentment, but when, you know, depression is really aversion to self in some sense. It's like, I don't like myself, or I just don't like the way I feel. And then that gets fed. And so this very physical element, the chronic disease and the boiling water, I think captures well these elements of aversion and the sort of broad spectrum of what aversion can refer to. I then had talked about the traditional antidotes that show up in the Visuddhimagga. And from that, I drew from Venerable Anālaya's book, Satipatthana, and the primary one is the practice of loving kindness. And this is a pretty sensible, logical sort of response. Okay. If there's something that's kind of fundamentally hatred that's in aversion, then the antidote to that is love. And that can, you know, that to just directly kind of try to bring loving kindness to aversion, it doesn't always work, just because There can be aversion to the loving kindness, as crazy as that sounds. But that, I described a while ago, some weeks ago, about being a little kid and having some teenage girls tell me I should smile, and how like resentful I was about that, and like I was like tell you know, and bothered by that. And so, you know, probably many of us have had moments in our lives when someone said we should, you know, cheer up, right? Or, you know, get over it, or, you know, why are you being so negative? That type of thing. And as we know, when we're in that state, oftentimes being told directly how we should behave, or that we should be the opposite of what we are, can actually create more of a reaction on our part. So I think we have to be careful with the idea that, oh, I should just throw loving kindness at my aversion. You know, I should just paint it over with loving kindness. I'm going to read a little bit from my own book, Living Kindness, my really underrated book, you know, not nearly purchased enough. And I track the purchases online because, so anytime you want to like get in my good stead, you just buy hundreds of copies of this. So this book was my attempt to kind of challenge some of the orthodoxy around the teachings of loving kindness that people that are kind of common. Obviously, they're orthodox, so and to try to bring some what I think are more nuanced thinking to the practice of loving kindness. So, you know, as I'm sort of implying, like loving kindness is sometimes suggested as this kind of just put some sugar in the tea sort of treatment, you know, just sweeten everything up. And it really misses that kind of idea, misses the nuances of it. So this is from a chapter I have, which is about the hindrances and the divine abodes, which the divine abodes are the qualities that the first, there's four of them, and the first one is loving kindness. So sometimes we refer to when we refer to loving kindness, we're kind of implying all four: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So bringing the attitudes of the Brahmaviharas to bear on the hindrances is one of the ways we can address them without creating more aversion. Rather than fighting with them, with the hindrances, we apply a loving mindfulness to them, a gentle acceptance and investigation. So you can see right away, I'm trying to get at, like, don't just do loving kindness to get rid of the aversion, but actually bring loving kindness to the aversion. Here we find ourselves again at the beginning of metta practice, giving love to ourselves, wishing ourselves well. It's so easy when experiencing one or more hindrances to think there is something wrong with us, or that we are meditating wrong, that we need to perfect our technique. But if we take the attitude that we are just experiencing the challenges of being a human being, it's easier to see that treating the hindrances kindly makes more sense than attacking them. Working with the hindrances, then, is tricky because, of course, we want to be rid of them. The Buddha himself says we should, quote, abandon them. The issue is, how do we approach this abandonment? How do we view the process? If we see our spiritual practice as some sort of self-improvement project, then we by definition think we are flawed. That kind of, although this book isn't about recovery, I think that, you know, you can hear the kind of resonance there with the steps 6 and 7 there, the, you know, character defects. If we see our spiritual practice as some sort of self-improvement project, then we by definition think we are flawed. We get so involved in this project that we don't see the inherent self-judgment in that attitude. Certainly, most of us want to be better people, but if that involves berating ourselves, how is that supposed to help? So one way of addressing the hindrances is to try to bring the qualities of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity to bear on the feelings themselves, on the desire, aversion, sleepiness, restlessness, or doubt. So for instance, if I'm judging someone in my mind and I see how agitated that makes me feel, I bring an attitude of compassion to that agitation, wishing myself well. Notice that I'm not criticizing myself for being judgmental. Judging is normal human behavior, not something aberrant that needs correction. Rather, I'm saying to myself, it's painful to judge people, and it's not worth it. This approach teaches us to let go of judgment, not because it's wrong to judge, but because it hurts. It hurts me. Seeing my own pain in any behavior is the most effective way to inspire change. So I was referring, that was pretty good too, by the way, in case you didn't notice. That was one of my better moments. Thank you. I like to see the smiling, nodding people. Smiling, isn't that a REM song? Happy, shiny people. This is kind of what I was referring to in the guided meditation, and it was very intentional that I was doing that, where I was saying that when we're taught meditation and we get this just sort of simple instruction, you know, let go of your thoughts and come back to your breath. Well, that's all well and good, and we might do that for a while, but then we all can start to find that our thoughts are very compelling, as I said, kind of addictive. And we need more of a reason to let go of the thoughts than, oh, you want to meditate, right? Stop thinking. Well, that's just sort of, again, about like trying to do it right. But that doesn't really prove it. It doesn't really prove anything or convince me that it's worth doing if I start to kind of question it. So the point then is that we need to see the unsatisfactoriness. That's sort of this kind of Buddhist term, the unsatisfactoriness of the thoughts in order to be motivated to let go, because they're very compelling, right? Again, kind of addictive. So this brings us back. This term unsatisfactoriness is one that's often used actually as a translation of the word dukkha, which is typically we call it suffering. So what we're talking about here, once again, is the Four Noble Truths. This is the foundation of all Buddhist teachings. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth that suffering ends, and the truth that there's a way to end it, the path to end it. And so what I'm talking about here is the truth of the cause of suffering, the second noble truth, seeing that. And this is something I just, I guess I emphasize it a lot, but I think it's really, really at the heart of practice. And I have some idea that it doesn't quite get clarified and pointed to quite enough, that as we're meditating, we watch what's arising, we see these hindrances, we see what they're doing to us in those moments. And when I say see, maybe I should say we feel what they're doing to us. And we feel the boiling water, We feel the chronic disease, the simile for desire. We feel the sense of indebtedness that we can't satisfy it. And so we see that these things that are very alluring to us that tend to be sort of the guiding mental directions or thought patterns of our lives are really not satisfying. So to speak in more sort of worldly terms, a desire is kind of what drives our economy. Get people to buy stuff, get people to want stuff, convince people that if they get enough money, that they're going to be happy. And if they buy this product, or if they, you know, spray on this thing that smells a certain way, that's going to make them appealing. You know, this just perpetual kind of, marketing that we're subjected to. But that marketing, of course, isn't something that just comes out of the blue. It comes out of an understanding of human psychology, right? The people who started advertising were people who understood the human tendency to craving. And they knew that if they could trigger people's craving, they could make money. And they understood that craving is this tremendously powerful force that's very, and it's, if you can kind of overwhelm people with their craving, they won't notice that it's not really working. You know, I mean, that's one of the remarkable things about it, right? That we fall for this over and over and over. And it's like, the thing is, it works for a minute, right? And of course, the studies that are really interesting are the ones that say the greatest moment of satisfaction in purchasing something is just before you stick your credit card in the machine. It's like, what? I don't really understand, but it's like, I'm going to have the thing that I want. Oh my God. And I think probably the same is true around sex, but I won't go there, but you can sort of, get that. So there's that, right? There's just this powerful energy. And the other one, the other side of it, is this idea, this other, again, worldly idea, and we see it particularly right now in our politics, right? Those horrible people, I need to get rid of those terrible people and their terrible things they're going to do. And once I can get rid of them, politicians use it in a different way, right? By stoking fear. I'm promising to protect you from those dangers. Anyway, don't even want to go there. But we see that these energies operate on these very personal, moment by moment, internal mental levels, and then they also operate on these great societal levels. What causes war? Hatred, greed and hatred. I want that land, so I'm going to go start a war to steal it, I'm going to invade that country. I want power, and so these energies are they're not theoretical, right? They affect us each in these very personal ways, but then they're operating on this global level as well. This is what spiritual practice is about. Is investigating this and being willing to investigate it. And it's a counterintuitive. It's counter to our sort of human impulse of greed and hatred, which are very sort of base instincts. And it does take some courage to confront these things, just in the same way it takes courage to confront your own addictions, because those habitual ways of being are very compelling. I want to talk a little bit about the Buddha and his own practice, his, the extremes of his practice. And this is, again, to try to kind of point to how we have to be careful in the way we work with in letting go. So there's some, you know, famous scenes and some really striking scenes in the suttas where the Buddha describes his efforts to attain enlightenment. And, you know, it's sort of most famous that he tried to starve himself. And that what's sort of strange about this is that it's like he's averse to any kind of pleasure, you know, that he's trying to overcome any kind of craving by starving himself. You know, and it's worth noting that ascetic practices have a purpose. Ascetic practices are meant to help us to develop equanimity in the face of discomfort. And they can be very powerful in that way. So when we get challenged to, you know, to be a little bit hungry, to only eat once a day as the monastics do, and then to see if we can maintain emotional balance around that. Now, I personally cannot maintain emotional balance around not eating, but any kind of sort of relinquishment in an ascetic practice is not meant to be a penance or a self-punishment, but rather a way of challenging us to be less reactive. But the Buddha was clearly kind of confused about this in his early practice. And one of the scenes that's most striking is when he tries to stop breathing. You know, it's like you're kind of saying, well, no, what are we doing now? Why are we doing this? And this effort at control, and there's this very aversive and aggressive sort of attitude in it. And he describes that that air starts rushing in through his ears. And it's just, I mean, you can imagine how you would be if you didn't try not to breathe. I mean, you know, you faint, of course, and then you start to breathe. But he's describing, it's sort of like his head is going to explode. And I think it's helpful that the Buddha kind of gives us these examples to say, like, this is not the approach. You know, if we're going to work with these difficult qualities of desire and aversion, we have to do it with kindness. So I don't know why that came to mind, but it was something that crossed my mind when I was meditating this morning. So, we've got some time left, and I'd love to hear from people if there are any thoughts or questions or reflections this morning. The last couple of sessions, I've kind of talked my way all the way through, so for once I didn't use up all the time. So anybody wants to just unmute themselves.
Hi, Kevin. It's Chris.
Hello.
How are you?
Okay. Well, I'm okay.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, I really appreciated the discussion on aversion. And I, just over the last 2 days, I guess things have really clicked at another level. Last night I was with another group reading one of Jack Kornfield's book, A Wise Heart. But anyway, he used the example of this group of scientists that were studying some gorillas, and they weren't having much luck. And this other group of scientists went in, and they had a lot more luck. And so they were asked, well, how did you do that? And they simply said, well, we didn't bring a gun, right? We didn't bring guns. And that is just so profound, right? I use mindfulness when I'm doing step 7 to deal with my shortcomings, as it were. I just pay close attention to them, but I'm afraid that I bring a gun, you know? So there's so many things I don't like. And how do you say, oh, hello, hatred, nice to see you? That's just so, greeting all my experiences with friendliness is just so difficult, you know? And against the stream, right? It's against my instincts, but this is what I really have to start doing, or at least noticing my aversions, you know, as you said earlier. Anyway, so thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, this is definitely the subtlety of the of this process, and why it's not a mechanical process. You know, I think we all want, like, tell me what to do. You know, the simple answer to how to do it. And oh, okay, here's the antidote. Okay, I'll just take that. You know, I'm actually looking in Jack Kornfield's earlier book for the part called Stopping the War. Yeah. And there isn't, you know, a pill, you know, there isn't a fix. It's subtle and requires this real dance, this real balance between engagement and a kind engagement, you know, and I was going to say effort, but I always think whenever I say effort, it always feels as if there is this a little bit too much striving in that word. Whereas if it's just engagement, then it's like, okay, I'm engaged. And I'm engaged in a kind way. And again, as I was referring before, it's like we can't even force the kindness in, you know, you know, because that becomes another kind of efforting. And so it's so subtle, and it's sort of why, you know, there are words to talk about this, but I don't feel that I can teach people how to do this. I can just kind of point to kind of how to approach it, and then everybody has to do it for themselves, clearly, right? We can't, nobody can do it for us. And I think this, you know, for me, there's this kind of a contrast with a kind of religious approach to spirituality, if that is not even like a weird sentence, but that sort of, I think of a religious approach as, you know, God says this, so you do this, say this prayer, and then, you know, you're done, kind of thing. Go to church on Sunday and okay, you're done. Whereas, you know, the Buddhist approach is be present all the time, you know, and try to act wisely given the specific circumstances that you're in at this moment and the causes and conditions that are arising right now. So that requires us to really stay engaged. Susan, you want to say something? Go ahead.
Well, my dogs are barking now. Oh, the other Susan, never mind. Go back.
I was particularly interested when you were talking about you can't just take desire and flip it over just by saying, or happiness, or like the person, the example you gave, somebody says, well, why don't you smile? And you just smile. It's, you know, you just, I can't do that. And I had a recent situation where I was a member of my HOA, you know, my board, my association, and you know the meetings are always pretty, you know. Anyway, one of the things they wanted to do was hire someone to shoot iguanas that are on our seawall in the backyard. And so these people would come out and with their pellet guns and shoot these iguanas right in the backyard, you know, right at my back sliding glass door. And I was so upset about this, you know, and the other three members of the board were determined to do this. And I was determined not to do this. And I just, you know, can't do that. And so we had this meeting, and I knew this meeting was coming, and talk about this fear, you know, and this anger. It was like overwhelming. And yet I had to somehow keep calm, you know, to state my case. And so the whole night before, I kept thinking about how it's okay for me to feel this way, like you were talking about, to yeah. not just try to flip it over, but to accept that this is how I feel. And it's okay. And so I pretty much spent the whole night, you know, trying to be okay with those feelings. And then I came to the board meeting, and I just don't know where it came from, but I was calm.
Wow.
I was just so calm, you know, and at first I stated the financial reason that we shouldn't do it, because I knew that's what they'd be interested in.
Right.
And then I said, and then the other side of that is personally, morally, I cannot be on a board that shoots animals in my backyard. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you vote to do that, I'm going to quit the board. Mm. And oh my God, I got so attacked. I mean, I got so attacked by the other board members. And so I can't believe it. I was just holding myself with this compassion, you know, as you were talking about. And I managed to get through it and stick to my ground. And resign from the board, you know.
Wow.
And so the problem was that, you know, even though I felt like I walked through that the way you describe, after it was all over, I held this resentment.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. It was like I had to find a way to let go of it, you know. And, you know, sometimes I still think about this, and I'm little by little, day by day, I let go of it. But the person just really, you know, cussed me out.
Wow.
And it was really personal. And I didn't say anything. And in a way, I'm kind of angry at myself for, you know, not saying anything. But I was afraid to. I figured I'd just go crazy. So anyway, that's my story, and I don't know how I could have handled it differently.
Yeah, thank you. That sounds really difficult, and I can really relate to all of it. And certainly, we are not saints, you know. Of course, we don't get over something like that right away, and you know, the only thing is to, you know, not dwell on it any more than you need to, right? Because you know it's not productive. And as long as you're not, you know, really working on the feeding that resentment, other than like it comes up and you feel like, yeah, there it is. But yeah, it's so interesting how defensive people are, because it's, you know, you're just stating where your stance, and they take it as a personal attack, right? Because, you know, it's just, you know, striking that it's like, it doesn't sound like you said to them, I think you're immoral for wanting to kill these things. You just said like, that's against my values. And, but they're like, well, you know, then you're telling me that I'm immoral, is, you know, and then it's like, no, I didn't say that, you know, I'm just saying, this is where I'm at. And, you know, that it's just interesting how fearful and defensive people become. But I appreciate that you resigned. You know, I think that's the skillful, to me, that's like, we could say like, oh, it'd be good to stay on the board and work from the inside, whatever. I mean, you're not in government, you know, it's like, you know, I think it's like letting them know that's, you know, where it's at. So Thank you. Since Susan Lee, you were going to say something. You still there? I see you're, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. I'm so glad to have heard Susan's story. That was very powerful. And I was just going to say something small along the same lines, which is that the, you know, how emotions just take their own time. Last night, I lost my glasses for the umpteenth time, and I decided to sit down and feel really bad about it. You know, I need glasses. I can't see well. I'm so old. I can't find them. This is, you know, and I just kind of was sitting with all of it. And my husband found them and brought them to me in the middle. And it wasn't done, you know. I didn't want that.
Yeah, the glasses. Yeah, take those glasses away.
I'm like, in a minute, okay?
Right.
So the desire for the glasses and the feelings around the glasses were completely unconnected to the glasses. It was really noticeable.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, we'll wrap it up, but just thank you, Angela, for putting in all that information about everything. we're going to do this retreat next week. I was just having aversion this morning to the idea of teaching a retreat, but I'm signed up to do it, and I got a responsibility to show up. That's part of my practice and my program. That's right, my program. Show up. Don't drink or use no matter what. So there's going to be this weird retreat that's going to be on East Coast time. So it's Southern Dharma, if you're interested. And then we've got the West Coast version happening at the end of September. We call it the Vajrapani retreat, even though we won't be at Vajrapani. And we don't know if Vajrapani is, I presume it's still there, but they're in the midst of some pretty scary stuff. There's been a lot of evacuations in that area. So anyway, we'll have that. And so these are kind of like self-retreat with benefits, I guess. I don't know. Teachers to help you through a self-retreat, basically, where we'll have three sessions a day, guided meditation and Q&A, and then a Dharma talk, and there'll be Qigong for each session. And in the evening, we'll have, we have these kind of 12-step style meetings. Some of you have been on these retreats with me. The name of the book about kindness that was discussed, it's called Living Kindness. That is my most recent book. So it'll be interesting, and I'm going to be curious to see how people's experience is. But if you want to have a retreat, you can definitely have a retreat on. And we'll be there to support you with that. If you want to just sit a few times a day and get some teachings, you could do it that way too. So it's really up to you how you would approach these retreats. There's very little cost for, I think it's roughly the same. It's like about $25 a day. And for the retreat at Vajrapani, we're simply having a cost in order to have people sign up. We're not going to keep any of the money that people pay to sign up. We're going to make it a donation. And anybody who wants to sign up who doesn't have money just has to say, I don't have any money or I can't afford it, and you'll be able to come. So that's the good news, right? That at least we can do this basically for free. So thanks for stopping by the basement, and stay safe. breathe, but, you know, you might want to wear a mask when you're breathing. So I'll be back on Friday evening at 7 p.m. Pacific. Probably going to talk about depression on Friday, if it's not too depressing. Yes. All right. Peace, safety.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks, everyone.
Take care.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin.